Okay, it's just gone past 8 o'clock. So welcome to the fifth talk in this series of talks on the Easter Retreat 2018. So far I've talked a lot about little metaphors for meditation, and some of those metaphors you can see just how they fit in to the usual way of describing our meditation practice. I know that sometimes people think that a particular practice has a particular set of instructions, but if you just follow those instructions blindly, you know, you find that it's like a map, but it doesn't really correspond to the territory. It's just like you go on a GPS to navigate your way through. And I remember once coming back from, I think, the Buddhist Society in London, having given a talk and going to where I was going to stay, south of the river, and the GPS told us to turn left and go over a bridge which was closed. We'd have gone straight into the River Thames if we'd have followed the GPS instructions. And you may have known that many times, that sometimes the maps are old and the roadworks have changed, which means that, you know, you have to not just use the instructions which you've been given blindly, but also, you know, be aware of where you are and use your insight. In other words, the instructions are there, and we amend, we change, to make sure we understand those instructions. We don't follow things blindly. And the classic story, many years ago, I wasn't there at the time, but this apparently happened, and if it wasn't quite as I explain it, it's still such an amazing example that it's worth remembering. It was in England some years ago that one of the nuns was going to some other place, and she had the driver, and she gave the instructions to the driver, go straight ahead at the roundabout. And you know what happened. When they got to the roundabout, instead of like turning left and going around the circle, they went straight ahead and over the middle part. The driver. And sometimes, you know, you can understand how that happens. People have so much faith in the teacher, in the instructor, that sometimes they misunderstand what the instructor means, and sometimes they get into big trouble. You told me to do that. Yes, that's the words I use, but it's not what I meant. So that's why insight all along the path is important. And at the same time that we know what they say in the Satipatthana Sampajana, we know the purpose, what we're doing it for. But that Sampajana, sometimes mindfulness, full comprehension, it comes from the word pajanya, which is a full extension of the word panya. Panya is a contraction of pajanya. So it literally means with wisdom. So you are aware, but you have wisdom as well, so you know what you're doing. And so that when we have the mindfulness and wisdom, we're not just mindful, but we realize there's a purpose to that mindfulness. And here we go with my old story about mindfulness, which is not with wisdom, just so-called mindfulness alone, pure mindfulness. There's no such thing as pure mindfulness, by the way, but sometimes we think there is. The story of the wealthy person, I usually say it's a wealthy woman, so let's say it's a wealthy guy this time. This wealthy guy who is got a really huge mansion and goes to listen to a Dhamma talk one evening and tells the guard on the gate, be careful because there's been many robberies in this area. I want to make sure that my house is safe when I go to the temple. And the guard says, no trouble at all, sir. I am a Vipassana meditator. I am mindful. I have trained in mindfulness. Your house will be safe. I will guard it like a hawk. So, great. Off she goes. When she comes back, she finds her house has been robbed. All her expensive belongings have disappeared. And he just goes up to the guard and said, I told you to look after my house. You weren't mindful. He said, I was mindful. How do you mean you were mindful? I've been robbed. But I was mindful. I saw a burglar going in, and I noted, burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw jewelry coming out, and I noted, jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I noticed this truck going in, truck going in, truck going in. I noticed safe on the back of the truck going out, safe on the back of the truck. Mindfulness alone is never enough. There's a purpose behind it. Why are you doing these things? And so that purpose is sometimes with kindness, with virtue, with learning, and especially in the meditation, the purpose of the mindfulness and the insight which you get is to learn how to be more still and more peaceful. Because with stillness and peaceful, your mindfulness increases. You see more, you understand more. So it is actually along the whole path, it's always like we're checking to make sure that we understand, you know, what peace is, what the joy is, what the wonderful state of mind where we feel energized, where the defilements just, sometimes they just, you're so happy they just cannot sort of get a, as they say, a foothold in, they can't grab you. And just how you get more and more peaceful and more alert and more awake. And we find that that is our path. So the mindfulness is always looking to see what's happening and to see just if there's any problems. And a lot of the times the problems in meditation, they are never solved by effort. People have tried that before and they just get into big trouble. And one of the cases of that, which a monk who's still a monk, and he was a monk who decided to, you know, to enlightenment or bust. So he decided to meditate all night. And as he was meditating all night, not moving, doesn't matter how much it hurt, he was not going to move his legs at all. But he sat there all night without moving. He got through the night. It was really a lot of endurance, a lot of agony. But in the morning, when he came out of meditation, we had to take him to hospital for a double knee reconstruction. And there was crazy stuff. There was another monk. This monk, he was the first monk who went into the Hampstead Vihara, or one of the first monks, in UK. Not of the Ajahn Chah tradition, but he read in the suttas. In the story of the Buddha, and he said that sometimes in the cold weather in India, all he needed was his three basic robes. His lower robe, this is the upper robe, and the outer robe, the Sangati. So he thought, well, you know, it's just a matter of endurance. If the Buddha can do it, I can do it. So in the middle of winter, when it was snowing, he went into Hampstead Heath, just with those three robes. And he just used those three robes all night. And in the morning, he had to go to hospital with double pneumonia. And that did not inspire the lay people. And there's something about that, that sometimes we believe ideas rather than just being observant of the reality. It's just like the GPS in the suttas. You know, it tells you to do this, tells you to do that. But if you really look what it really means, you know, you see, you do have some restraint, but you know it's just the right amount because it leads, you know, to things like peace and happiness and stillness, not the opposite. So, we always need our wisdom. We always need to be checking. I always need to, not with our with our intellect, because that intellect has let us down too often, but just to feel, how peaceful are you getting? So with the insight, what I already mentioned to you, Ajahn Chah, Samatha Vipassana, they always go together, you can't separate them. But all of those, it is, you know it's Samatha, you know you've calmed down, because it makes you more, it increases your insight, you see more. The more you slow down, the more calm you get, the more still you are, the more you see. I'm not talking about with your eyes, the more you know, the more clarity there is. And the more clear you are, the easier it is to get calm. So the insight leads to calm, and the calm always leads to insight. You can't separate the two out from one another. However, some people think that insight, you can know the power of your insight by whether you can argue with people on a blog and convince them they are wrong, because your insight is better than their insight. But of course, that isn't real insight. When there is arguments, I always go back to what Ajahn Chah said. But I'm going to go back even further from what I remember reading in a Zen book before, where there was one Zen monk, and he saw another Zen monk and said, you know, that to be a Buddhist, you have to accept reincarnation, that this is not our only life. And the other monk said, no, you have to live in the present moment. The future is uncertain. The past, who knows? So in the present moment, how do you know? You've got to keep an open mind. Now the monk said, but no, the Buddha said, you know, that there's reincarnation, otherwise it doesn't make sense. But, you know, you're in the present moment, it may be just a perversion of your perceptual apparatus, vipalasas. So the other said, no, you're wrong, I'm right. So no, I'm right, you're wrong. So one of them said, I'm going to go and see the teacher. They went to see the master. He said, look, it says in so many places that reincarnation is a fact. You see, the Buddha remembered all his past lives. He remembered his you know, only six more lives if you're a stream winner. You know, the Buddha would be telling fibs if it wasn't true. And the master said, oh yeah, you know, you're right. So he went outside knowing he'd been confirmed by the master. He said, see, the master said I'm right. And the other monk said, he couldn't have said you're right. I don't believe that. So he went home to see the master and he explained, you know, the future is uncertain. You know, the only thing you can really know is this present moment. All that could be just like a framework of perception. You know, but now is the only time you have. This is the most important time. The thing in front of you is the most important thing in the whole world. The only thing to do is to care. And the master looked up and said, yeah, yeah, you know, that's right. And so the second Zen monk, see, the master said I was right. And the first one said, he couldn't have said you were right. I'm right. He said I was right. So they decided to go into the master together. And then the first one said, no, I talked about reincarnation. You said I was right. And the other said, but no, I said you have to live in the present moment. And you said I was right. We can't both be right. And the master said, yeah, that's right. I kind of like that one because that's what happens. That's what happens when you go into the intellect. And what Ajahn Chah would say, when people would do things like that, he would say the first monk, you are right, but not correct. And he'd look at the other monk and said, you're correct, but not right. Because that's the trouble with insight. If we look upon it on that sort of level, we're not going deep enough. Causes arguments. So, real insight is what leads to peace. That's how you know it. And sometimes you can be deceived by insight. You think that you've seen the truth, and you go around telling everybody else, claiming you're enlightened, or whatever, and I can't go past. I know some of you, I tell the same stories every retreat, but there's some of you come on the retreat for the first time, and the other ones are getting old, so you've probably forgotten. But that's what I rely upon. As I get older, so do my disciples, and so I can repeat the same old stories, and they think they're hearing it for the first time. Thank you to Dementia. Anyway, that was a story in Colombo, in Sri Lanka. I'd only heard this a couple of years ago, so it's not that old a story. And about they had a meditation center. Not just meditation, but study of suttas as well. You know, it's all the rage now. You do jhanas and sutta studies all together. But this was special. I think it was about a month or 5 week course. And afterwards, the teachers, there were lay teachers, they would actually assess you. They would give you an exam. You know, in your understanding of the Dhamma, especially the deeper stuff, and also your practice of meditation. And then they would discuss, you know, your progress. And then, amongst the faculty, then they would award you confirmation of any achievement you've made. Give you a certificate. So, you know, it was really like giving enlightenment certificates and jhana certificates. Approved. You know, that Ananda has got the third jhana with psychic powers. Not this one, Ananda, sorry. There's many Anandas around. So they were giving all these certificates out. And anyway, there was this old auntie from up in the hills somewhere in countryside Sri Lanka. She was visiting her family down in Colombo. And she was one of these really devout Buddhists and the sort of ones, you know, go to the temple, you know, keep the precepts, the pansula or the eight precepts and do dana and just know all the chanting. You know, you see those, you know, in Thailand as well. You know, they just go to the temple, they bow and cook for the monks and that's all. And so, but she was a devout Buddhist. So they thought, what can we get our auntie, our grandma? Something special, because out of gratitude for bringing us up. And they thought, wow, this is course. We can sponsor, because it's expensive. Not like this place. This is the cheapest and the best. So it was very expensive, so they all clubbed together and they say, you know, grandma, auntie, would you like to be sponsored for this retreat? She said, okay. So, you know, they're pretty easy going. So off she went to the retreat, meditating, doing some studies, you know, going to lectures, and in the end, you know, getting the faculty members to, you know, give her a little test and understand what she's doing in a meditation. And then they came up to her and said, Auntie, we're so pleased. We've discussed your case and we've admitted, we've concurred, we've agreed that you are now a Sotapanna, a stream winner. That's in Sri Lanka, the soul one. And many people in Sri Lanka, oh, they'll give an arm and a leg to be a stream winner. They wouldn't give their defilements and their attachments, but they give an arm and a leg. But she got angry. She got angry at them. And they said, Auntie, why are you getting angry? You know, the Buddha said, better than conquering the whole world is the achievement of stream winning. You're now no longer can you go to any lower realms. Now you're destined for enlightenment, 6 more lifetimes at most. This is a great reason for joy and a wonderful thing you've done. You know, it's amazing. You know, we've all agreed, no doubt, you're a stream winner. Well done, Auntie. Why are you angry at us? And she looked at them, really angry. And she said, you don't remember me, do you? And they, what? The last time I was here about 4 or 5 years ago, you said I was a non-returner, an anagami. You've demoted me. That's why I'm angry. And that center closed up a short time afterwards. So news got around. Even I heard about it. So for goodness sake, these are things that really you can only know inside by yourself. That's the inside. See how calm and how peaceful you are. So especially the best way of knowing, you know, just your progress or rather ingress, is just Now, as you're meditating, it's not a case of just being able to say, you know, there's no attachments, but have you got any attachments? You can always say, it's all one and stuff like that, I've got no attachments. But then you say, oh, can you give me your bank details and your passwords, because you've got no attachment, because the nuns' monastery in England needs it more than you. Well. After a while, it's just all gomayang, as I say, it's just superficial. So what we actually do, the way of meditation is sometimes the best way to understand just where you are at, or where, rather, you is not. So it's a way of like using the path of calming the mind down, and knowing that insight is required at all stages to get deeper and deeper and deeper. Little things like your body, how to sit, or how to walk, or lying down meditation, whatever. Still, people keep saying, oh no, real meditators, I mean the real ones, not these namby-pamby cream puffs who just come here for a weekend and just go back and do all their other little stuff. This is the real meditators. They sit, get rid of those cushions. Get rid of broken glass. Be tough, full lotus, no matter what. Straighten your back. You're tougher than pain. You know, that if you really want to be enlightened, no pain, no gain. And some people actually think like that, because sometimes they look at other teachers. I fell into that trap really early on. The first Waisak ceremony I went to was in Cambridge. It was actually Dr. Sadatissa. He took it for the students, and he told the story of the Buddha, and he told the story of sitting down and making the vow. Even though my blood dries up, and my bones turn to dust, I will not move from this seat until I achieve full enlightenment. And you know, it wasn't I was inspired. I was so incredibly arrogant. And I thought, well, if the Buddha could do it, and he wasn't a Cambridge scholar, so I could do it. And he was Asian. I am English. And anyway, I didn't have much time. I've got other things to do in life. So, proud, arrogant, Peter Betts, my name before. I went to my room, and I put my sitting cloth, all the sitting cushion, just to the right face. It was Waisak Day. And I made my vow. I said, I actually did this. Incredibly stupid. But I said, even though my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust, I'm not going to move from this seat until I too get fully enlightened. I sat there. I was serious. I was really serious. So how stupid you could be. And I lasted 40 minutes. That was a record for me. 20, 25 at most was all I could do in those days. And I was absolute agony. Couldn't last any longer. I opened my eyes, and I wasn't enlightened. And I looked at my bones, and they were still intact. My blood was still and dried up. Yeah. I just realized just the arrogance of force and effort. It's coming from the arrogant part of your ego. I want to achieve. I can do this. I'm as good as other people. Why not? And that type of arrogance gives you a lot of pain and a lot of frustration as well. There's no insight there. So how can you sit long? It should be obvious. You're comfortable. You've got not too many aches and pains. Do a bit of yoga if you like beforehand. Stretch your muscles this way and that way. Get really, really good. Then just the cushions in the right place, just under your left, right knee, just the right amount. Get in a chair, lean back, whatever. Get just nice and warm. Don't look at me. When I look at you with all those blankets, and I think, wow, this is not a sauna. This is enough for me. In fact, it's much better if I could take a bit off. You know, just that's, you know, in my room over there, if I meditate, you know, just usually do take much more off so I can be much more cool. So, because that's how I was brought up. That's my metabolism. So you get yourself, you, comfortable. And then you relax your body. And what do I mean by relaxing the body? You have insight on how to relax things. As I mentioned, just with a tummy ache, or with a sinus cancer, or with a headache, or whatever it is. You know, you're aware of it. You get to know it. And this comes on now to a little story, which when I did do my walkabout through Thailand as Tudong, just like a bird, you'd always, you know, try and get to see some of these amazing monks, you know, in the Thai forest tradition years ago. And one of those monks I went to see, just for your information, was a monk, we got his photo up in the dining room, it was a monk called Ajahn Sing Tong. And it was from him that I learned how to chant. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Because this monk, he was a forest monk, he was really well respected, and he would do the blessing. You know, we do the blessing, yata, wari, waha. Do you do those blessings in the hall, nuns? Yeah, good, very good. So I was there and I was listening to him, you know, and he was going, yata, wari, waha, pura, pari, parenti, sagaran, ewa, mewa, ito, dinam, beta, dang, upaka, iti, dang, pati, dang. And I just did not know what to do. I never heard anything like that before in my life. I thought this is crazy. But of course, you know, that sort of craziness is contagious, and so I caught it from him. When I do my, but you know, he was just so well loved by everybody. You know, there was the happiness, the joy, which, you know, came from his chanting, which was contagious. And see, all of the villagers, a lot of these monks, they were just looked after by the wealthy people from Bangkok. But this monk, all the villagers, they would all come every day. And so you can see just how he was loved, because he could connect with them, just have a bit of fun and joy like that. And so when I do the yata, when I do the sadhu, 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 it's not original, I'm not just inventing things. That was from Ajahn Sing Tong, his little method. And I think it works. It gets people alive. Instead, they can get so bored with ceremonies, you know, we're just doing the same old, you know, and it is depressing, I must admit. When you give a talk and afterwards people go, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. You put all that effort into the talk and that's all you get, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So thank you for being big sadhus, that makes it much more meaningful. And the other monk, which I went to see many monks, one of those monks I went to see was the toughest, the fiercest, the hardest of monks in the whole of northeast Thailand, and that was Ajahn Mahabua. Really tough. But when I was there, he decided to give a talk, and I was only there for a week, and he said it for the Western monk, pointing to me. He gave this talk, so it was actually given, especially for me. And that was a talk, he said, that when he was a youngish monk and he was studying under his teacher, Ajahn Mun, that he had malaria fever. And a malaria fever, that was just what all monks who lived in a forest would get from time to time. There was no escape from it. But it was really debilitating and just... But this was a tough monk. So he was in the hut, with a fever, sweating, you know, as you know, when you have malaria fevers, and then the bell rang for the chores, sweeping. And this monk said, I'm a monk. So if the other monks are sweeping, I will sweep as well. So he managed to sort of stagger into an upright position, put a little robe on, and then crawl down the stairs, pick up a broom and start sweeping in the middle of a malaria fever. You know, that's how tough he was. And when Ajahn Mun saw him, he said, you stupid monk, And this was wonderful, actually, coming from Ajahn Mahapur's own lips, self-deprecation. And he said, that is not the way of a Buddhist monk. We don't fight. We investigate. Get up there and contemplate, explore your sickness. Don't fight it. And that meant so much to me, coming from that particular source. Whatever problem you have in your meditation, or even in your body, don't fight it. Explore it. Understand it. And that particular lesson has helped so many people. Even to the point of, you know, that I go to this Cancer Support Association to give talks on meditation. They come here every year. And the head of the cancer, this is called Solaris now, twice he's come up, because you know, he was a survivor of cancer, and so he spends a lot of his time looking after other people with that disease. And he came to me because he knew my answer. He's known me a long time. And he asked me, so in public, and he said, Ajahn Brahm, what do you think of this idea of fighting your cancer? And I said, that's what kills you. That's what made you have a cancer in the first place. He said, he smiled, he said, well done, thank you. And he asked me the same question next year. He didn't have dementia, he just wanted to reinforce it. Because he's been there, seen that, done that, talked with other people. That aggression, that tightness, that tension, that is what caused it in the first place. There's other ways. There's beautiful kindness, there's softness, there's gentleness. Caring for your body, caring for your mind. That is the insight which comes along. It's not maybe my bones dry up and my body and my blood dries up, well, but they both have to dry up eventually, that I'm not going to move to get enlightened. Yeah, even though the Buddha says that, as I know for a Buddha, there's used a lot of insight and a lot of wisdom to be able to get to that stage and know what that really means. So, understanding you have to look after your body. This is why all those little experiments which I did, and myself having the typhus fever and being able to get into deep meditation, other little things like with the mosquitoes in the jungle, you know, just getting sort of eaten alive by mosquitoes and just learning just how to focus inside rather than outside, which brings me on to something I haven't talked about yet, about focusing the insight in not just holding things firm to escape from them, but just allowing your mind to go into the center of things. Because when the mosquitoes biting you, there's so many mosquitoes and it was so irritating. We'd sit for 2 hours in the evening the first year at Wat Nana Chart, because Ajahn Chah was there. And you know, so often you'd open your eyes, you want to run away. Your teacher was there. Felt too embarrassed to run. If he wasn't there, I'd be out of there. I'd have become a monk to, you know, be eaten by mosquitoes. There's other places to meditate. But there we were, stuck for 2 hours, you know, irritated by mosquitoes. So I soon learned just how to go inside, just to focus in the center of things. Not with effort, but just allow the mind to settle on a very internal part of what was happening. Later on, when I started traveling a lot, whenever you see the in-flight video, not the video, the safety demonstration, you look at the screen in front of you, and after a while you can't see the upholstery of the back of the seat in front of you. You can't even see the edges of the screen. Your mind actually fits in to the center of the screen. It naturally focuses. Same if you do watch a TV, you find actually your mind goes inside, it fits perfectly. And it's also why that you see people with little movies or something on their smartphones, a tiny little screen, and you can actually look in there and your mind fits in perfectly. So you don't see the edges. And what that is about focusing. What I was doing, looking at my breathing, I just focused on the breath. And my mind like zoomed in. It's like Google Earth these days. That's the way I describe it. You know, you zoom in on Google Earth or Google Maps. And as you go in, what's on the outside just falls away. So soon all you can see is your breathing. I couldn't feel my body. And it was just zoomed in on the breath. And the breath was so much more pleasant than my body, because the body was being eaten by mozzies. So because of pleasure, it didn't need any effort. It was just no more effort than, you know, when you want to escape from the sun by going in the shade. So there I went into the breath, and you couldn't feel the body anymore. But you could sit perfectly, happily, for a couple of hours, and that's how I learned how to focus in. And so this is little insights you get on how to practice. You don't get rid of those feelings in the body with negativity. Now sometimes those mosquitoes, they would take advantage of you. They knew that I couldn't swat them. There was just evolution, because those mozzies have been in Thailand for such a long time, like mozzies in all Buddhist countries. They know a bald head and a brown robe is a safe dinner. Which means they go for you. And they know that you can't swat them. So you know that sometimes what you used to do, you just flick them. They wouldn't kill them, so they'd just go somewhere else. You know what they'd do? They wouldn't go anywhere. They'd just do a loop-de-loop and land somewhere else. So you'd have two. And so now the next thing you did, you said, okay, it's only a tiny little bit of blood. You know, it's only a little irritation. Okay, just have something nice to eat. Come on. And have something to drink. And so the mosquito would land there. And they'd realize that, you know, you were letting it drink some of your blood. And again, they'd exploit your kindness. They put their nose down there, and it was only like an experimental borehole, like they're doing mining. Now, that didn't taste nice, so they go somewhere else and put another in their nose somewhere else. You know, those mosquitoes, three or four times they'd drill a hole before they found something they really liked. So you had four itches instead of just one. Anyhow, that was the nature of things. So anyway, what you did, you learned how to just to go inside. A nice bit of insight. So you don't fight these things. You explore them and find right in the center of things, there's no problem. That was interesting, just on malaria, Nain Ajahn Chah, that's how he overcame his malaria fever. That he was, I think the first year he was in Wat Bapong, he was still suffering from malaria, but one day he was meditating and got a malaria fever, and he just said to me that he just got fed up with it, basically. And then he decided to go right in the center of it. And he said it was like going into the center of a cyclone, the eye of the storm. Right in the middle, it was really cool. But nevertheless, he could still perceive this incredible, like, heat encircling like a fire, getting hotter and hotter and hotter. But where he was staying in the center, it was really cool. But hotter and hotter and hotter, but he was really quite still. But he knew that, you know, just, you know, a little ways away, it was just incredibly hot with the fever. And he got hotter and hotter and hotter, and then it exploded, and that was the end of his malaria fever. Never had it again. Interesting, isn't it? Just instead of fighting it, you just go in the center. You know, the nice cool place. The heart of the lotus. It's always centering. Inside is the path. That's what I really mean by insight meditation. Excite is when you go out and it gets all, you know, excite. It gets all sort of topsy-turvy and distracting and disturbing. But in the center of things, there's always a lot of peace. So there you go. You go inside the body. I don't mean sort of, you know, looking at your organs or your bones or something. It means like this idea of the body, inside of that is your mind. And inside of time. And it sounds so easy to let go of the past and the future. You have to use a lot of insight to do that. And there was that marvelous story, don't say it more in detail now, which has helped, one of the key stories, you know, which I use for life and for meditation and for sicknesses and also for things like cancers and diseases and mental health issues. And it's the monster in the emperor's palace. And so that story is, you know, it's gone viral. I see many other people start using it in their therapies, but it really works. So the story in brief, there was an empress who, no, that's a transgender emperor. And the transgender emperor was away on a meditation retreat. And after 9 days, when they went back, they found a monster had come into the palace. And this monster was huge, ugly, and very frightening. Now, you do have security, but sometimes those security guards, they're not paid that much. So, if a big, violent monster comes into the palace, it's not worthwhile, you know, to sacrificing my life just for my pay rate. So they hide under the tables, they just go in the cupboards, they hide behind the flower pots, they make themselves scarce. So the monster went right into the centre of the palace, into the main hall, and onto the throne. And that was just a little one step too far. So all the guards, the security, even the army, the soldiers came out and said, "Get out of here, you don't belong, who do you think you are? Get out from here." And those few unkind words, those few unkind deeds, those few unkind thoughts, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more frightening, and more smelly. And by the time the emperor, the transgender emperor, came back, "Oh, come on, I'm trying my best. I know it's not perfect, but..." came back. Then the monster was huge and so ugly. It was disgusting. And I always mention the smell, the stench coming from this monster was worse than in the sewers. In fact, even the maggots which were crawling over the skin and the pus filled slime oozing from this monster skin, even the maggots threw up. They couldn't stand it either. But the transgender emperor was there because wisdom. You know, it's a meritocracy, deserved to be there. You don't judge people because of their age or race or religion or gender orientation or anything. Just, you know, just whether they can do the job or not. And this transgender, she was so wise. She took one look at the situation, or he, one look at the situation, and straight away understood what needed to be done. Said, "Welcome, welcome, monster. Why have you waited so long to drop by? Has anyone got you a cup of coffee yet? We've got Colombian, I don't know what you've got." You ask the other monks, they're experts at coffee over there, but I don't know much coffee. "Or would you like a cup of tea? We have a cup of tea from a single estate in the hills above Nuevalia. Is that right?" "Very correct, yeah, he." "Been paying attention. And would you like just plain or green tea? Or would you like some condensed milk?" "We've got everything, a monster. And what about something to eat? Would you like some biscuits or some sandwiches or some noodles with that?" And this empress, who was sincere, wasn't playing around. The empress really wanted to look after the guests with lots of kindness. And then what happened? The monster grew an inch more or less ugly, less smelly. Every kind word, every kind act. Which meant all the people in the palace, they realized their mistakes, so they amended it. The insight needed some action, change of attitude. So they about 20 of them gave the monster a foot massage. Huge feet. And the monster was so happy. Oh, just, oh, that's it. Just that. Just, oh, yeah, thank you very much. And every kind of act, the monster grew smaller. Some of the other people in the palace, they say, well, what if we can get a monster? What do monsters eat? And one had this wonderful idea. Monster pizza. Because apparently, you get monster-sized pizza from the pizza store. Do you? I never ordered anything. But anyway. So we give you a monster-sized pizza for a monster. And every kind act, word, or deed. The monster kept shrinking, getting smaller and smaller, until the monster got so tiny. One more act of kindness, and the monster vanished completely away. And that, as you all know, was based on a story in the Yaka Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya told by the Buddha of the anger-eating monster. You give it anger, and it gets bigger and more frightening and more disturbing. You give it kindness, and the monster gets smaller and smaller and vanishes completely away. Wonderful little bit of psychology and insight from the Buddha, and that's what you use in your meditation. Get out of here, dullness. I've slept so much already. This is only a couple of days to go. Come on, get out of here. And your dullness gets bigger. You say, welcome, dullness. Thank you for coming to visit me. Ah, has anyone got you a nice pillow to lay your head on, dullness? And then the dullness gets less. Or frustration. Come on, get out of here. I'm not going to be frustrated. And say, welcome, frustration. Thank you. Wonderful thing to understand and get insight into what frustration is. Come on. Let's have a look at you. You're welcome. Which brings me on to what I was meant to be saying at the beginning of this session about the Emperor's Three Questions meditation. It's amazing how you come around in a circle in the end, eventually. If not this retreat, next retreat. And that's the same as the story of the lotus opening up through mindfulness and kindness. This is that story from Leo Tolstoy, Emperor's Three Questions. An emperor who was fed up with organized religions. And if you don't like organized religions, you should come to our BSWA AGM because it's very disorganized. But we do try our best. It's human beings, that's all, so you can't blame anybody. But anyway, we do try our best. So, they're no one's fault. But anyway, so he decided to make up his own religion. Realize there's only three questions you ever need answers for. When is the most important time? Who is the most important person? And what is the most important thing to do? When is the most important time? It's always now. There's no other time than now. The best time to meditate? Now. The worst time to meditate? Later. How long should you meditate? Just now. Is it too long? Well, what do you mean too long? It's only now. That's the only length of this. Just now. But now is the most important time. And so we had, who's the most important person? It was always the one in front of you. So in meditation, what is the most important thing to watch in meditation? What is the most important meditation object? Your breath? Nimittas? Loving kindness? Body? What is the most important thing to watch? Whatever is right in front of your mind now. It's a beautiful answer. What are you aware of right now? That is your meditation object. So I developed that when somebody asked me, said, I'm sick, I'm tired, I've got all these pains in my body, I can't watch the breath, so I can't meditate. What are you talking about? Meditation is not watching the breath. Am I supposed to watch the nimittas? I can't get nimittas. No, not watching the nimittas. Oh, what am I supposed to do? Loving kindness meditation? Look, what is in the mind right now? What are you aware of? That's what you watch. So what do I do? Care for it. Don't try and cure it. Don't try and develop it. Don't try and get rid of it if you don't like it. Or hold on to it. It's really important. I've got to keep this. Care for it. Empathy questions meditation. So powerful. All the same way of looking at the path of meditation. Now the only time you have, whatever it is in front of your mind right now, is most important. Most important. So care for it. But that also answers a question that sometimes people, they're meditating and they're watching their breath and the breath disappears. Ah, what should I watch now? Or whatever you're aware of. Or what's that? Well, look, you're not unconscious, you're not dead. So you must be aware of something. What is it? Just because you haven't seen it before, you haven't got a name for it. Just now leave it there and get to understand it. If it's something unpleasant, it's teaching you something. So just let it be. An ache, a pain, something so tired, too hot, too cold, whatever it is, be with it. It's important. It's teaching you something. If you care for it, it soon sort of gets very present. So that's a lovely way of understanding just the Emperor's Three Questions. It's exactly what Ajahn Mun was telling Ajahn Mahabua. You go there, you don't get rid of the fever, you don't fight it and conquer it. Right now, the fever is right in front of you, right now, it's the most important thing in the world. Care for it, get to know it, understand it, explore it. That is insight. Sometimes we think that insight is something in the future. The inside is just something where we understand the blissed out mind which is full of jhana experience. But we use whatever we have for insight. Right now. What time for the old man, old men, old monks don't lie? Sorry? Okay, here we go. Nice end for this morning's talk. This is one of those stories which comes up just now about insight, enlightenment, getting all the wonderful things of the Buddhist path. Already mentioned about the tradition of wandering from place to place with no fixed abode, but even so, for 3 months of the year, it's called rains retreat, you know, in Sri Lanka, Wassa, Pansa in Thailand. It's a time when the monks are not allowed to go anywhere. They have to stay put in one spot. So there was this old monk who was wandering from place to place. He came to a small farmhouse belonging to a very poor person and his wife and kids. And the farmer who lived in the house was a Buddhist. So he invited the monk, "Please, venerable sir, can I offer you some alms food for today?" And so the monk accepted the food, and then the farmer said, "Venerable sir, it's soon coming to the rains retreat. Have you got a place to stay yet?" And the old monk said, "Actually, no." And he went down, he put his hands up and said, "Venerable monk, I invite you to stay with me. Not far from here is a lovely tranquil meadow next to the river. It's so easy for me to build you a very simple basic hut to keep you safe from the rain and the wind during the retreat. And please, you just meditate there as much as you like. All I will ask is when you come, you know, to give me to my hut to get the food, please let me supply all your food and needs. And once a week, now please, if I have anything to ask on meditation or the Dhamma, can you please instruct my wife and I? And also I have 2 children. Maybe just tell them a few stories about how to be good kids." He said, "Certainly." So he accepted the invitation. And so the farmer built a very simple hut. And the monk would meditate there happily for most of the day, every week. And once a week he would come to the hut and just give a little Dharma talk, answer questions on meditation, and just talk to the kids And even their dog got to love that monkey. It was such a kind, peaceful, it had just such good vibes. They always looked forward to him coming to the house. So you can imagine after 3 months, the monk came to the house and told the family, "This is the end of the range retreat. Tomorrow I will leave." And the man, even though he knew that these things were impermanent, he went down on his knees, "Please, Venerable Sir, don't leave. We love you all." And the wife also, "Please don't go." And the kids started crying. And even the dog put his tail between his legs and started whining. They all loved the old monk. He said, "Look, I have to go. It's our tradition." "But," said the old monk, "my meditation has been so fantastic during this last 3 months, and it's because of you. So out of gratitude, I want to let you know that few powers have developed, and I've located very close by, closer than you realize, there's a huge buried treasure. I know you've been very poor, and I think you deserve, you know, to live a more easy life. So I want you to have that buried treasure." And they were all excited, even the dog. "But," said the monk, "you have to follow the instructions. So listen carefully." So they all listened carefully. Even the dog's ear went up. "And tomorrow morning," said the monk, "I want you to stand at the doorway to your hut and face the rising sun. And as the dawn breaks, as the sun starts to rise, I want you to pick up that bow and arrow you have in your house and point the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun. And when the disk of the sun separates from the horizon, let the arrow fly, and where the arrow falls, there you will find a great treasure." "And," said the old monk, "follow my instructions and you'll be rich." "I'm an old monk," he said, "and old monks don't lie." And off he went. And so even though they missed that monk, still they all knew that the following day they would be rich. So the following morning, the farmer was there together with the wife, the two kids and the dog, really early. He was waiting, waiting, waiting for the sun to start rising. He stood in the doorway of his house and he picked up the bow and arrow and he pointed it in the direction of the rising sun. And he waited until the disc separated from the horizon. He shot the bow, shot the arrow, sorry. I get excited too. Shot the arrow, and they all ran after it. And where the arrow fell, they dug a big hole. What did they find? Nothing, only trouble. And they dug that hole, nothing, kept on digging. And soon, a man came. And he said, "What are you doing? That's my property. You can't destroy my property. I am a lawyer. I'm going to sue you. I'm going to take every last bit of property you have. Even though you're poor, still I can take all your land, your house, everything. You can't do that. That's illegal." And then the farmer said, but an old monk said we find a treasure here." "Did you say old monk?" said the lawyer. "Yeah." And the lawyer said, "I'm a Buddhist too. Old monks don't lie. So, there must be something to this." So, when he heard the instructions, the lawyer said, "Oh, I know the reason why you didn't find the treasure. Look at you. You're just so poor. You're all skin and bones. Lawyers, we're fat. So, I'll do a deal with you. I will shoot the arrow tomorrow, follow the instructions, and then we'll share the treasure. But we have to sign a contract first of all." So he signed a contract, 49% for the farmer and his family, 51% for the lawyer after deducting fees. Well, of course. So the farmer had no choice but sign. And the following morning, the lawyer was there with the farmer, his wife, the two children, the dog. And it was time to shoot the arrow. And the, the lawyer being sort of, you know, just more sort of muscle to his, as well as the fat, obviously, but more muscle. The arrow went much further, and they all ran after it, the poor old lawyer panting as he went. And by the time they got to where the arrow hit the ground, they all dug a really big hole. And what did they find? Deeper and deeper they dug. What did they find? Only even more trouble. Because that landed in a field belonging to a general in the army. And the general was coming by with his soldiers, and he said, "What are you doing, destroying my property? Cut off their heads, all of them, including the dog." And the lawyer said, "No, you can't do that, it's illegal." "Well, I don't care about that," said the general. And the farmer said, "Oh, but an old monk." "Did you say old monk?" said the general. And the general said, "Wow, old monks don't lie, and I'm a Buddhist. Now, don't ask me what a general has been doing, cutting people's heads off when he's a Buddhist. He certainly didn't come to my temple, but never mind." So he said, "Hold on, what did the monk say?" And when they told him what the monk said, they said, "Ah, it's obvious your mistake. You know, a lawyer, a farmer, what do you know about archery? You've got to be in the military to know how to shoot an arrow." So he said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I will shoot the arrow tomorrow morning. We'll split the treasure three ways." And so they hit the general was there the following morning, waiting for the sun to rise, standing in the doorway of the house. And as the sun rose, he picked up the bow and arrow, pointed it in the direction of the rising sun. And as the disk of the sun separated from the horizon, he shot that arrow. It went such a long distance. He was a professional. And they all ran after it, including the lawyer again, and the farmer, his wife, the two children, and also the dog. The dog is really important. Don't forget the dog. And where the arrow fell, they dug this huge hole. And what did they find this time? Real trouble. Because this time the arrow fell in the garden belonging to the king. And the royal guard arrested all of them and dragged them in front of his majesty. And his majesty said, "I'm surprised that each one of you, especially you, general, you've done such a great service to my kingdom, but the law is the law. You above all should know, and you lawyer as well, that destroying royal property is a capital offence. I have no choice but to execute all of you, even the dog." And the poor dog couldn't defend himself, tail between his legs, whining. "But," said the general, "these people said an old monk told them they'd find a treasure here." And the king said, "Did you say old monk? Because I'm a Buddhist too, and old monks don't lie. What did they say?" And the king couldn't understand what they'd done wrong. They seemed to be following all the orders. But, you know, he said, "This is really interesting. Old monks don't lie." So he said, "I'll commute your sentence for a few days until I can find that monk and get to the bottom of this." So they put all the general, the lawyer, the farmer, his wife, the two children, and the dog in a nice little cell. You know, and even the dog, you know, just had a nice food, you know, in the cell. And while they were there, the king sent out troops to find the old monk. They eventually found him, and they brought him into the palace, and they had everybody out there, and the king scolded that old monk. "You've got these people into big trouble because, of what you said. Why?" And the old monk said, "Your Majesty, because they did not follow my instructions." "What do you mean?" He said, "Your Majesty, may I invite you to that poor farmer's little hut tomorrow morning? May I invite you to follow my instructions? And I guarantee, Your Majesty, that we will find the treasure tomorrow morning. I'd only ask you one thing. Can you please split the treasure in four ways equally? Be shared between Your Majesty and with the general and with the lawyer and with the poor farmer and his family. Because I know that even your quarter share would make you very happy. How much would that make a poor farmer happy?" They didn't really have any choice. So the next morning, the king was there together with the general, the lawyer, the farmer, his wife, the two children, and the dog, yeah, and the monk. And so at dawn, the king stood at the entrance to the house, the farmhouse. And he looked at the monk, and the monk nodded. Yes, Your Majesty, correct. First instruction completed. Then he waited till the sun started rising and picked up the bow and arrow. He turned round to the monk. Correct, Your Majesty. And he pointed a bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun, turned round again. Correct, Your Majesty. And just as the disk of the sun was about to leave the horizon, oh, it's 9:06, so I'll continue the story tomorrow. Okay, I'll do it now. No, I'm sorry. So just as the sun was about to rise and separate from the horizon, the king was just about to shoot the arrow from the bow and looked back at the monk and said, "Wrong, Your Majesty." That was their mistake. They did not follow instructions. "What do you mean?" said His Majesty. "I never said shoot the arrow. I said let the arrow fly." And the king explored that idea for a while. He had the arrow between his thumb and forefinger. So he opened up his thumb and forefinger, and the arrow flew. He let it fly, and it went right down between his legs, right where he was standing, in the here and now. And there they dug a small hole and found an immense treasure. And that was so much that for the rest of his life, the dog ate the most exquisite dog food from a 5-star Michelin dog chef, staying in an air-conditioned dog house designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. That's the dog's with an endless supply of delicious bones to chew on. I never had to do anything else for his whole life. Even got somebody else to do the barking for him. The moral of that story is not just the treasure. Is when you shoot the arrow of craving, of wanting, over somewhere else, into the past, into the future, tomorrow I'll become enlightened. When you shoot the arrow of craving, what do you get? Nothing, only trouble. But when you let the arrow of craving fly, where does it go? Right where you're standing, right here, right now. And there you will find a treasure beyond your wildest dreams. So you never have to bark for the rest of your life. Oh, by the way, wait for a moment. That, I guarantee, is true. That is truth. You know why? I am an old monk. An old monk's no lie. So... Sadhu. Sadhu.